I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight. Proudly born and raised in Maysville, South Carolina, Kathleen Hines is a doctoral student in the Department of English at Southern Methodist University, a recent graduate of Converse College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, you had that on here, I'm sorry. Ms. Hines graduated with honors in English literature following the presentation of her honors thesis in 17th century English literature in the wake of the plague. Though her undergraduate research addressed early modern English sermons, drama, and literature, Kathleen has developed a burgeoning interest in Southern literature, with a particular focus on Southern female writers and their responses to the War of Southern Independence. Presenting a paper entitled Women in the Confederacy at the Abbeville Institute this past summer, she continues to expand her research and hopes to produce further publications addressing the women of the South and the reactions to Lincoln's government. Her presentation this evening is Overcoming but Not Subdued Southern Women and Mr. Lincoln's War. On top of this, Kathleen owns two English Masters, Junius and Boudicus, and so don't mess with her. Ladies and gentlemen, Kathleen Hines.
I'm going to appreciate the applause now, because by the time I get through this sort of tortuously long draft, you may not want to applaud at the end, so thank you. This is really nice. I promise that I also won't torment you with the plague. That was undergrad, that was my past life. Before I begin what Chaucer might term my little treatise, I believe it important to delineate the current view of Confederate women, perhaps best embodied in Stephen Vincent Benet's poem, John Brown's Body. These are a few of the lines from the poem, and they really describe well the 20th and 21st century views of Confederate women. She knew her Bible and how to flirt with a swan's down fan and a brocade skirt, for she trusted in God, but she liked formalities, and the world and heaven were both realities. This view may be reckoned a trifle narrow, but it had the driving force of an arrow, and it helped Mary Lou to stand up straight, for she was gentle, but she could hate, and she hated the North with the hate of jail when the dry, hot hands were seeking the nail. The terrible hate of women's ire, the smoky, the long-consuming fire. The Yankees were devils, but she could pray. For devils, no doubt, upon Judgment Day. But now in the world, she would hate them all and send out the gentlemen to kill. Benet was by no means the only writer to portray Southern women as fanatics driven by an ignorant and passionate hate. In his work, The Women of the Confederacy, published in 1936 and regarded as the first serious scholarly study of Southern women, New Deal-era historian Francis Butler Simpkins wrote, "By such championing of the Confederate cause, the women of the South did their share in bringing on one of the greatest wars in American history. They put themselves in an aggressive state of mind by indulging in the belief that the North was in a conspiracy against their happiness and social welfare by assuming an intransigent attitude toward those who disagreed with them, by fervently proclaiming the justice of slavery and other phases of Southern civilization, by imagining the South to be unconquerable because of the supposedly superior quality of its morale and military forces, and by thoughtfully boasting of their prowess, and by acting as though they were not on the brink of a serious tragedy." Placing the blame for the war on Southern women, Simpkins, Benet, and subsequent writers and historians have confined them to a cage of ridicule. In Simpkins' work, each paraphrased line iterates an incomplete history, beginning with servile insurrection and ending with female fanaticism. However, belying such revisionist historiographies are the words of the women themselves, words which Simpkins and subsequent revisionist historians have buried. Their defense lies in their words, those of mothers, wives, and daughters who saw the fabric of their nation rent by a war, of which the harder part, according to Robert S. Henry, was the woman's part. If war proved more difficult for Southern women, it was because they fought it on multiple fronts. Managing plantations increasingly threatened by the pillage of Union troops, running hospitals and nursing the wounded and sick of both sides, the women of the South were also forced to defend the Southern cause in ink. Their defenses proved as intellectual as they were passionate. Observing their written testimonies, historian Catherine Jones writes in her book, Heroines of Dixie, "It was commonly observed at the time by foe and friend alike, and has been repeatedly noted since, that it was among the women of the South that the spirit of resistance flamed highest." Revisionist historians have attributed this resistance to Southern women's desires to preserve slavery. Simpkins writes of women who fervently proclaim the justice of slavery and other phases of civilization. These other phases he does not proceed to name in the rest of his book. Fearing servile insurrection, he writes, the women of the South read in the Southern cause the protection of their dearly held peculiar institution. In his writing, however, Simpkins ignores personal correspondence and published work in which these women parsed out the implications of slavery and, more expansively, the political and economic agendas posed by Lincoln and his unconstitutional actions against the South. Perhaps the most complex and well-articulated of these views was from Miss Louisa McCord. Christened Louisa Susanna Chevis in 1810, Ms. McCord was born to parents whose own births coincided with America's first great war for independence, instilling in her blood the patriotic sentiments of her predecessors. The daughter of South Carolina Attorney General and later President of the Bank of the United States, Langdon Chevis, and mother Mary Dulles Chevis, the young Louisa spent her childhood receiving a unique education. Her father, recognizing her scholastic aptitudes, proceeded to educate her in Latin, French, and mathematics, from which she gained the valuable knowledge which she would later apply in her translation of Frederick Bastiat's Sophisme Economique and in articles often solicited by the editors in Southern Quarterly Review and a number of Northern publications on politics, women's rights, and slavery. While her articles are of rare note, Miss McCord, like many women of her generation, was characterized best by her private correspondence, often as erudite, if not more so, than her published works. Richard Lounsbury records that her works were often presented in the form of open letters, including articles aimed at British abolitionists and her famous Letter to the Duchess of Sutherland from a Lady of South Carolina. These letters attested to the brilliance of a mind brimming with enthusiastic literary adeptness, yet tempered by an unwavering sense of intellectual pragmatism. Hers was an intellect that recognized in slavery an economic root to be ended only through gradual and measured responses. Turning to cultural history, classicism, and etymological discussions of slavery and equality, Miss McCord viewed slavery as an evil made necessity in the South, just as she viewed the slave as an individual meriting protection and care. To a query asking why she wore no jewels, she responded, "A woman with 200 children could hardly afford diamonds." This remark pointed not only to the great burden of slavery upon her, but more importantly to the belief, as her character Cornelia in her play, Caius Gracchus, attests, that slaves are like children, jewels of a parent's caring eye, not to be cast about the neck, but carried upon loving shoulders. Miss McCord's own views of slavery were also those fettered by the yokes of political economy and the knowledge that abolitionists in the North did not wish for equality or freedom for their African or Southern counterparts. In a letter to Henry Carey, she wrote, "You believe the Negro to be an oppressed race, while we believe him to be a protected one. You assume the ground that we are committing a constant injustice towards him, while we are convinced that we are his only safeguard from extermination, at least in this country." Carey, who later became Lincoln's principal economic advisor, would adopt Miss McCord's view. While he refused to veer from his policies of increased government regulation of the economy, he admitted that slavery was an inevitable economic reality that could only find its end in gradual political measures, already proposed by Miss McCord, her contemporaries, and Abraham Lincoln himself in 1854. Slavery for the women of the South was no motive for war. Instead, its institution was meant to protect the race later exploited by the North during and following that war, as the gang rape of slave women in Columbia and the use of black soldiers as Union cannon fodder later suggests. McCord's own Cornelia from Caius Gracchus again iterates the female Southern view best. Her character writes, or speaks, "Man has in every station rights his due. Our slaves look to their masters for support. The very claims we hold upon their labor make us a rule to tender them again what comforts we can furnish to their lot. If placed by circumstance, necessity, beneath our rule, protection thence we owe. And he, evading basely these, degrades himself below the thus defrauded slave." The testimonies of other Southern women support Miss McCord's statements. Through their private pens, women might not feel apprehension in expressing honest thoughts regarding such controversial issues. Such was the case of Miss Susan Bradford, who at the tender age of 15 found herself embroiled in the controversy of Florida's secession from the Union. In her diary, she wrote, "Mother says she wants the Negroes freed, but she wants the United States government to make laws which will free them gradually. All agree on one point. If the Negroes are freed, our lands will be worthless." From the mouth of babes. Often, the latter point of Miss Bradford's journal is interpreted to mean that the South went to war only to defend the institution of slavery. However, if the South and its women supported the institution, it is doubtful they should have espoused gradual freedom of their slaves or instigated a war over the preservation of the institution they wished to end. Women espoused not slavery, but states' rights, the ability of state governments to regulate their own economic and political paths. For the South, slavery's end was inevitable. Its end, however, was not to occur in the fiery statements of ignorant abolitionists and those who championed slaves' freedom, but not their equality. Madam Sophie Sosnowski, a Jewish South Carolina schoolmistress, particularly perceived in Lincoln's invasion motives other than the championing of the slaves. Of Union occupation, she wrote, "One among the Yankee soldiers made a regular stump speech, in which he endeavored to demonstrate that this country was destined only for the white man, and that the Indian, as well as the Negro, had to be, or in the course of events, would be, exterminated." If we think back to Louisa McCord's speech, she mentions the same word, extermination, a word later adopted by this Yankee soldier. Of the treatment of black women by Yankee soldiers, she also wrote, "The scenes enacted at the dwelling in connection with the Negro servants are not fit for female pen to dwell upon. At last, the black men themselves became thoroughly disgusted and vowed vengeance for the base treatment their women had been subjected to." If the rape of black women and the extermination of the Negro race reveals a Northern attitude of emancipation, in the minds of Southern women, it exposed an opponent bent more upon the destruction of all than the union of any. Lincoln, in a speech in Peoria, Illinois in 1854, would say, "Free them all and make them politically and socially our equals? We cannot make them our equals." The actions of both Lincoln and his military leaders would certainly support Madame Sosnowski's testimonies. If in the Southern woman's mind, slavery and equality were not the dictates motivating Lincoln's declarations of war, instead, they were its red herrings. History, according to Ms. McCord, could illuminate this fact. Common sense and observation, according to her female Southern contemporaries, would also admit to it. Southern female views of slavery testify to women who practiced compassionate but pragmatic thinking, that which sought to address and end slavery without destroying the Southern, and by extension, American government. For it was the fruit of the agriculture of the Southern economy that paid upwards of 2/3 of the total revenues of the federal government, a sum Lincoln could ill afford to lose. If slavery was not the motivation for secession and war, the question remains, what did sway the women of the South to such ardor for the Southern cause? The answer lies in the rights of the state, which women viewed as sacred and necessary to the preservation of a union that they defined as a loose federation of states with unique and varying interests. The only union binding these states was their mutual consent to be governed by a federal government whose duties could not constitutionally exceed Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. These duties were limited and included, among others, the establishment and maintenance of a national army, the declaration of wars against foreign powers, and the coining of money. Yet in Article 1, Section 8's final clause, the government was called upon to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever, as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States. Simply, the federal government was one created by a federation of states to ensure and maintain uniformity in the states with regard only to matters exercised by those states together. Matters in which states maintained individual interests were left expressly to those states. The South's women recognized this, and when the debates arose and the Southern states chose to secede, women did not take secession, its constitutional right, or Mr. Lincoln's violations of the Constitution lightly. In a private diary entry titled The Madness of Coercion, young Emily Mason alluded to the parallels between secession and the history of its constitutional right, alluding to the madness of a union government increasingly more motivated by coercion than compromise. This she encapsulates in a brief account of the speech of Senator Douglas. Of course, we're all familiar with the Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1854. This particular passage was her paraphrase of those events in Douglas's speech. She writes, "You may declare war against a state, but she cannot be coerced. Such is the language of Mr. Madison and George Mason in the debates in the convention which adopted the Constitution. And such is the spirit of the Bill of Rights. At this time, Virginia, and ever more clearly, New York and Rhode Island reserved to themselves unequivocally the right to secede. And now people deny this? It seems to me that the Constitution bears as many interpretations as the Bible itself." Ms. Mason's astute records reveal a mind grounded in the history of a nation and its constitution. Southern women were aware of the constitutional rights afforded the states, just as they were equally aware of the consequences seceding states would face under Lincoln's administration. If Lincoln, they reasoned, were willing to deny the right of secession to the states, what would he do in the preceding tenure of his presidency? Catherine Ann Devereux Edmonston, in her Diary of a Secesh Lady, wrote first of Lincoln's blockade in 1861. Miss Edmonston recognized in the blockade a violation of both constitutional and international law. She cites the Paris Declaration of Maritime Law, which in 1856 declared a blockade only binding so far as it was effective in preventing the importation of goods across enemy lines. She spends quite a few paragraphs talking about how ineffective Lincoln's blockade proves to be. In 1861, the U.S. government, under Lincoln, had agreed to respect the boundaries of this international declaration. In the case of the South, however, it appears such agreements had fallen apart. That a Southern woman could notice such a finely tuned point attests to the intellectual vigor and observation such women possessed and iterated in their diaries. As the remainder of my list will indicate, these entries were by no means few and far between. Miss Edmonston also records Lincoln's illegal appointment of Edward Stanley to the governorship of North Carolina in 1862, and also cites Lincoln's Declaration of the Emancipation Proclamation in 63, both illegal under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, led Miss Edmonston to conclude, "What unprincipled villainy! He does his best to inaugurate a servile war? What a usurpation of power! For never did fanatic maintain that the right to free the rebel slaves lay in the president." Even Beecher, Stowe, Greeley, and that set looked to Congress to fulfill their wicked designs. Others besides Miss Edmonston continued to record Lincoln's increasing atrocity towards civilians through his abandonment of the Constitution. In July of 1861, Betty Herndon Maury wrote, "Abraham Lincoln professes to conduct this war on the most humane and merciful principles. Yet he has declared all medicines and surgical instruments contraband of war, a thing never before heard of among civilized people. And now, having deprived us of all means of attending to our own sick and wounded, he leaves his poor soldiers to our care. They have never sent back for any of their wounded or to bury their dead. Our soldiers buried them in trenches, 50 and 60 at a time." The consequences of such violent action, both against his own men and those of the Confederacy, would lead to what a Union soldier witnessed and recounted as a gruesome scene in a house in Tennessee. The building was crowded with women and children, all of them refugees from Georgia and South Carolina, infected with the measles. In one room, he discovered the corpse of a woman and her young son, and in the next room, another woman who had just given birth to a child, both of whom had little chance of survival. Women clearly perceived, through the suffering of their loved ones and themselves, the consequences of Lincoln's actions. This is indisputable. What such record, however, reveals is the fact that women could cite, with exceptional mental acuity, their support for the war and hatred of Lincoln as products of constitutional violation. Yet women's hatred of Lincoln was by no means a hatred of the Union or of Northern sympathizers. Often those who fought under the banner of Union disliked Lincoln and his policies even more than their Southern counterparts. Kate Cummings wrote of quite a young man named Knott, one of the wounded Yankee prisoners. Of him she wrote, "He says that he dislikes Lincoln and abolitionism as much as we do. Declares that he is fighting to save the Union and nothing more. All of them say the same thing. What a glorious Union it would be." If women did not support Lincoln, they certainly supported the Union. Whatever passion Southern women aroused for the cause was balanced by a knowledge that to submit to Lincoln's Union, and not Union in its true sense, was to submit to a government that ignored the statutes of the Constitution and ignored, in an account by Susan Bradford, the South, which had done more to establish the Union than any other section. It was a Southern man who wrote the Declaration of Independence. It was a Southern man who led the American Army. It was Southern men who framed the Constitution. A Southern man wrote our national anthem, and in so doing, had immortalized the Star-Spangled Banner. That a young woman of the Confederacy would emphasize this point stresses the belief that the South supported the Union, formed in great part by its own men, as much as it underpins their efforts to sway the North to recognize their reasons for leaving. To those in the North, many of whom were their intimate friends, the women of the South passionately wrote, "Pleading for understanding and lamenting the cessation of ties with those who cried Union over unity, In a private letter to a northern friend, Sue Sparks Keith sought to explain the South's reasons for leaving the Union. She passionately wrote, "My dear friend, you say the hand of the South will not be raised against you. It will be raised only in self-defense, and I know you will not join the ranks that come here to fight us. You must allow me to say that we are right in this movement you condemn, and you must believe me when I say we did not break up the Union you so much love, nor bring about the crisis you so much deplore. You speak of your devotion to the Union. We Southerners once loved it with the heroic love that Virginius loved Virginia. With our own hand, we would consign it to eternal death rather than see its robes of state upon a mountain bank, its sword of justice turned into an assassin's dagger, and the constellation of its flag shining on fratricidal battlefields. The Union of the people of the North ask us what? To save the Union by submission to Lincoln. What does that submission imply? National disgrace, sectional subjugation, poverty, exile, and ruined homesteads. We have suffered long and deeply. All we asked was freedom from molestation. All we have done is withdraw from the Union when it fails to guarantee our safety. When the cries of starving needlewomen, filled operatives, and deserted wives rose in the streets of northern cities, did Southern philanthropy seize the sword and cut the purse strings of hardened money kings to benefit the one? And did Southern chivalry touch the lance and force recreant spouses back to their duties to console the other? No. We minded our own business and let our neighbors alone. Like yourselves, we deprecated civil wars. Quietly and with dignity, we withdraw ourselves from insults and oppression, and seized the sword only when hostile ships floated in our waters and the war cry was heard in council against us." Most notable in Miss Keats's letter is her prophetic mention of the consequences of war. In war, she saw exile, national disgrace, and sectional subjugation, already in practice by a president who openly declared in 1861, a year after Miss Keats's letter, "There needs to be no bloodshed or violence unless it be forced upon the national authority. The power confided to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government and to collect duties and imposts." The women of the Confederacy clearly perceived the tyranny of a government seeking to cry union as a means of subjugating each state and peoples to its will. If Lincoln and his Union wished to avoid bloodshed, Miss Keats argued, when the first threatening note was heard, why did they not say, "The Union, dear as it is, shall not be preserved at the price of our brother's blood"? Or that failing, then said, "You have wronged the people. In peace, let them go. Civil war we will have leave of." But no, it was the Union, no matter what the cost, no matter how disgraceful the party in power. That a woman could so keenly grasp the inherent clash between the Union's presupposed sentiments and its call for war suggests keen intellectual observation, as much as it supports her assertion that sectional subjugation would result from a direct attack of the states, who possess the right to protect their interests not delegated to the federal government in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. That such rights were being violated and that secession was valid are, as Louisa McCord declared, beyond argument. That Southern women adopted an intransigent attitude in declaring such, however, is false. Many women, including Miss Keats, adopted no such attitude. They pled with their Northern counterparts as ardently as they pled with their own families and friends in the South and abroad. In a letter to Hiram Powers, that famous sculptor expatriated to the European lands of his muses, Louisa McCord wrote, "We of the Southern United States have been constantly so misrepresented, loudmouthed fanaticism has so cried down our institutions, and pretended philanthropy so covered us with slander and falsehood, that it would be asking too much of a far-off spectator to understand and appreciate our action. I wish I could show you how right we are, but it would require a perfect volume of a letter to give the history of almost half a century of slowly encroaching injustice. I have no right to trouble you with all of this, and can only say that, slandered as we have been before the world, we have yet courage to bide our time. The phrase, bide our time, alludes to George Crowley's poem, Woe Upon Israel, and alludes to the belief on the part of the Confederacy's women that secession was a reply to encroachment upon constitutional rights and the South's reputation and a call for a re-examination of the slander unjustly imposed upon it. With regard to her perception of the invasion, Miss Judith Brockenbrough McGuire also spoke of the hospitality these invaders, who placed such slander before the South, in spite of their vociferous slander, posed. During the war, she recalled, "How many Northerners, perhaps the very men who have come to despoil these homes, to kill our husbands, sons, and brothers, to destroy our peace, have become partakers of the warm-hearted hospitality so freely offered by our people, the parlors and dining rooms now so ignominiously searched, how often have they been opened and the best cheer which the houses could afford set forth for them? I do most earnestly hope that no Northern gentleman, above all no Christian gentleman, will engage in this wicked war of invasion. It makes my blood boil when I remember our private rooms, our chambers, our very sanctums are thrown open to a ruthless soldiery. But let me not do them injustice. I believe they took nothing but the rifle and injured nothing but the sewing machine." Miss McGuire's account is much more fair-minded to the occupiers than their overall behavior likely merits. Simpkins argues, although there was little systematic destruction and burning during the first few years of the war, the Federal soldiers frequently, though by no means always, followed their entry into settlements of women by resorting to pillage. In some cases, they were actuated by greed for plunder. In others, they were impelled by hunger and need for forage. He cites no cases with regard to the Union need for forage, instead proceeding to recount these frequent but clearly exceptional circumstances in which Union soldiers were impelled to such destruction. Simpkins, the revisionist historian, writes of a North Carolina woman whose house was sacked, furniture chopped to pieces, hogs and cattle killed, and their carcasses thrown into a fire, and her carriage and horses taken away. Exceptional. Another exceptional case involved a Mississippi woman who reported that Union troops looted the storerooms of her plantation and rendered the rest useless by pouring molasses and vinegar upon them. Ironically, Simpkins here succeeds in contradicting himself with his own research. Is it a wonder that such behavior could induce disdain in Southern women? And yet this disdain was often silent, confined to expressions in private letters and not in public spaces. As Miss McGuire sought to alleviate the outspoken wrongs of those who invaded her private chambers and sanctums, so too did many women attempt to reconcile the atrocious behavior of the troops to the conditions of war and defeat. Rose O'Neill Greenhow, who we famously know as the great spy Rebel Rose, ascribed their behavior to one of their many initial defeats in Richmond, writing, "Alas, their plight was pitiable enough. Some were described as being minus hat and shoes. Amongst this latter class was Colonel Burnside, who sallied forth for Virginia and is said to have required two orderlies to carry the flowers showered upon him by the women of Northern proclivities. The Northern troops had been taught to believe that a bloodless victory awaited them, and so possessed were they with the idea of their philanthropic mission as liberators of an oppressed people that many officers took far more pains to prepare white gloves and embroidered vests for the balls to be given in Richmond than in securing cartridges for their muskets. When consulted on the subject, I said, no doubt they would receive a great many balls, but I did not think that a very recherche toilette would be expected." The fanatical feeling was now at its height. Maddened by defeat, They sought a safe means of venting their pent-up wrath. The streets were filled with armed and unarmed ruffians. Women were afraid to go singly in the streets for fear of insult. Curses and blasphemy rent the air, and no one would have been surprised at any hour at a general massacre of peaceful inhabitants. The apprehension was shared even by the better class of United States Army officers. If the witticism of Ms. Greenhow's remarks has been perceived by scholars of the Lost Cause to be disrespectful, boastful, or rude, it cannot be attributed to an imbalanced aggression. Ms. Greenhow's lines are those of wry pity, those of an observer attuned to the animalism that war calls up in those maddened by defeat. And yet, this maddening defeat did not characterize the behavior of Union troops in victory. In Missouri, a Southern lady wrote, "Our home was raided and robbed. A box of old family silver was unearthed and taken. Keepsakes were appropriated, and even a locket containing a dead child's hair, amid the piteous entreaties of a mother to spare her one small treasure, was taken." In Tennessee, Alice Reddy wrote of a Miss Putnam, who reached Murfreesboro from Nashville, where she says exists a most complete military despotism. "The houses are all being searched. They entered for that one purpose. The lady was sick, quite so. But regardless, as usual, of the sanctity of a lady's chamber, they went in and stripped the bed where she lay of each piece of covering, looking for Texan rangers and arms. The accounts, however, make no judgment of the men beyond condemning their actions." Critical to the response of Southern ladies were their refusals to comment upon the actions of Union troops until aroused to do so in response to Union pillage, boasts, and audacity. When, for example, a Virginia woman refused to play the piano for the invaders of her home, one of them seated himself at the instrument. He had scarcely begun to play, however, when the owner, raising the piano top, severed nearly all the strings of the instrument with a hatchet, and shouted to the astonished performer, "That's my piano, and it shall not give you a moment's pleasure." Such behavior, Simpkins argues, was unjustified aggression. To Southern women, their remarks were their best defense against a force which held as its mission the destruction of their sons, husbands, and brothers, and boasted of the arch-rebel who suffers not the grass to grow under his flying feet. Of the female Southern reactions to Union occupation, aggression of the tongue was not matched by aggression in action. Betty Herndon Maury wrote in a brief diary entry, "Uncle Charlie and many gentlemen here have been up to Manassas to see the battlefield. He returned this evening, says that many of the soldiers, Yankees, are still lying upon the field. Our men are burying them." Recalling this scene of burial, women of the South sought to bear record of Southern compassion as much as they became the bearers of such compassion, even under cruel occupation. Cornelia Peake McDonald recalled, "Soon men came and carried the dead away to make room for others who were dying inside and would soon be brought and laid in their places. Most of them were Yankees, but after I had seen them, I forgot all about what they were here for. I saw a pair of sad-looking eyes looking intently at a pitcher the servant carried. I stooped and offered him some. It was lemonade. He could not raise his head up to me, so I poured it into his mouth with a tablespoon. He looked up at me so thankfully. It is a beautiful drink for a thirsty man." Even in the midst of personal want, the women of the South never hesitated to help those they saw in need, even those they saw in blue coats. Ms. McDonald concludes, "The men, the surgeon said, were dying, and the ladies looked pityingly down on them and tried to help them, though they did wear blue coats, and none of their own were there to help or weep over them." In the minds of Southern women, human life in need was not defined by its uniform or allegiances. If the principles or actions of Union men were cruel, the wounds they sustained at the hands of war were much crueler. To the Southern woman, duty meant the healing of all who felt the burden of war. For in the separation they felt from their own loved ones, they reasoned, those women of Northern proclivities would wish care for the men over whom they could not weep. This understanding of the universal human suffering of war resonated with Southern women from the war's hopeful beginnings to its much more difficult ends. At its beginning, Miss Judith McGuire wrote, As I looked at the Capitol in the distance, I could scarcely believe my senses. Can it be possible that it is no longer our Capitol? And are my countrymen under its very eaves, making mighty preparations to drain our hearts' blood? And must this union, which I was taught to revere, be rent asunder? Once I thought such a suggestion sacrilege, but now that it is dismembered, I trust we must be a separate people. Our nationality must be different to ensure lasting peace and goodwill. Why cannot we part in peace? For the women of the South, the disintegration of the Union entailed the turning of friend against friend, brother against brother, and the Union against the South, many of whose men had been instrumental in creating and glorifying that very Union. From its momentous inception to its tragic end, these women prayed with their husbands, brothers, and fathers, both for peace and for God's guidance to both sides of the war. Mary Custis Lee, with her noble husband, quoted, "For we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle be dissolved, we have a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Never was prayer more fervent, tender, and touching. If consistent with his will, God would still avert the threatening danger and grant us peace." Later in the war, Lincoln would prevent such public prayer for Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis, consigning such prayers to those we perceive in Miss Lee's own diary to private correspondence. Yet, as their constitutional rights were usurped, Phoebe Yates Pember would write in 1864, "The women of the South still fought their battle, fought it resentfully, but calmly and silently, clad in their mourning garments, overcome, but hardly subdued." Letters, diaries, and memoirs attest to the strength of Southern women, strength of purpose, deeply seated senses of duty, and the knowledge that a merciful Creator would bless their cause and their duties, from their great beginnings to their tragic ends. They approached their duties quickly and without hesitation, writing, "We are very weak in resources, but stout and strong in heart, zeal for the cause, and enthusiastic devotion to our beloved South. And while our men are making a free will offering of their life's blood on the altar of their country, women must not be idle. There is much for us to do, and we must do it." Even as their homes, men, and lands fell to invasion, women maintained their faith and courage, leaving behind a written legacy in their letters, diary, and poetry of a South that had fought to maintain the nation established by its forefathers. Louis Wigfall, writing of the Confederate flag, beautifully summarizes the women and the cause they understood and fought for so nobly. She concludes of the flag and of the cause, "The hands of our women made it. 'Twas baptized in our mother's tears. While the blood of the men who bore it flowed fast on the reddened plain, till our cry went up in anguish to God for our martyred slain. And we wept and watched and waited by our lonely household fire. For the mother gave her firstborn, and the daughter gave her sire. And the wife sent forth her husband, and the maiden her lover sweet, and our hearts kept time in the silence to the rhythmic tread of their feet." Thank you.